These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it be so, why am I thus?" And she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said unto her, "Two nations are in thy womb. Two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger." And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red all over like an hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother out, and his hands took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was there 80 years old when she bare them. And the boys grew, so on. Now, here we have the first recorded birth of twins. If we study the passage closely, we discover that Rebekah had been barren for 20 years. She had been married for 20 years without a child. And now the children came. And the first point that I wish to bring out, that the Bible clearly teaches that children are not the gift of nature, but of God. That they are desired by Him, and that God is the one who is the author of childhood within us and the creative faculties by which we pass on life to our children. And furthermore, that the details of the lives of our children are planned in advance before they are born. The details of your life were planned in advance by God before you were born. I say that children are not the product of nature, but of God. And I read you for that purpose Psalm 127, verse 3. "Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is His reward." It's very interesting in the light of the modern desire of people not to accept the inheritance and not to have the reward that God wishes to give them. Most certainly, the limitation of a family is one of the greatest sins that can be committed by any person, and undoubtedly is going to be a sin that will be judged by God in the settlement of the reward that anybody is to have. I'm always delighted when I see a large family and know that God has indeed blessed in such a way. Children are the heritage of the Lord and the reward of His grace. Now when these two boys were born, there was the red boy and the white boy, and the announcement that the elder was to serve the younger. They were to be the fathers of two distinct nations. They were to have different characters. And these characteristics were to be shared by their descendants. God announced what the nations were to be centuries before their descendants were born. They would contend with each other for superiority, and the elder would serve the younger. Now, if we study the Bible, it is interesting to note that this prophecy was not fulfilled in the children themselves. For Esau did not serve Jacob. It was Esau's great-great-great-great-grandchildren that served Jacob's great-great-great-grandchildren. And here we have one of the greatest illustrations of the sovereignty of God and His planning and His seeing far down the years, 1,000 years or so in advance, and saying things are going to be that way because I, God, have planned it. Now Esau was much the stronger. We have only to read his genealogy in chapter 36 and see all the dukes of Edom, the princes, the strong men, the mighty men that came out of Edom, while Jacob was a poor shepherd. I say the prophecy did not begin to be fulfilled until the time of David. And if you turn to 2 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 14, you have this verse concerning the submission of Esau to Jacob. And David put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom put he garrisons, and all they of Edom became David's servants. And the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. There was the first time that the elder served the younger. 1,000 years passed from Abraham to David before this prophecy was fulfilled. Edom became a great nation. Jacob became a great nation. Jacob was the weaker, and he became the stronger. And since that time, this prophecy has been fulfilled to the utmost detail. I suppose that if I gave a piece of paper and a pencil to everybody here this morning and said, write for me an outline of the book of Obadiah, I probably would have a great many blank papers. And yet, when we turn through the minor prophets, and most people will have to see, let's see, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah. And then they will go to find out what this little prophecy has to say, but it's all in the fulfillment of what I have just outlined here. It's a prophecy with only 21 verses, but listen to verse 6. How are the things of Esau searched out? How are the hidden things sought up? All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread have laid a wound under thee. There is none understanding in him. Shall I not in that day, saith the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Edom? Edom, of course, is Esau. And understanding out of the mount of Esau, and thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed, to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. Now isn't it interesting? Because a man was violent against his brother, God slaughters his descendants 1,000 years later, 1,500 years later. Someone says, that's not just. And here we are face to face with the greatest doctrine in the Bible, the sovereignty of God, his right to do what he pleases when he pleases, because he knows that it is the right thing to do. Drop on down in Obadiah to verse 17. But upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. And the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble. And they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Lord hath spoken it. Now this was announced before the babies were born. Now, this is not the full extent of the fulfillment, what I've read here. You can read the 25th chapter of Ezekiel and find a whole chapter on the burden of Eden and the burden against Esau. What we find here is set forth in God's sovereign choice of the Jews. For Jacob, of course, was to be the father of the 12 tribes. And if you turn to the little book of Malachi, on the first verses of the chapter, God tells you why he chose the Jews. In Malachi 1, 1 and 2, the burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. I have loved you, saith the Lord. Yet ye say, wherein hast thou loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother? saith the Lord, yet I loved Jacob, and I hated Esau, and I laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness, and so on. Now, if we turn to the New Testament, we find that this incident forms the center of three chapters and the announcement of God's plan of history. For if you turn to Romans chapter 9, verses 10 to 13, we read the following. Romans 9, verse 10. Not only this, but when Rebekah also had conceived by one, even by our father Isaac, for the children being not yet born, neither having done any good or evil, so that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of him that calleth, it was said unto her, the elder shall serve the younger. As it is written, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. Now, the marvel, of course, as has often been pointed out, was not that God hated Esau. And if anyone has any doubts and says, why, you mean to say God hated somebody before he was born? Yes, he did. Because he knew what he was going to do. Well, would God do a thing like that? Just stop a moment. The difficulty is not that God hated Esau, because Esau was hateful. And Esau deserved to be uprooted and to have his children killed from off the face of the earth. The miracle is that God loved that spindling little crook, Jacob. For he was nothing to talk about. He was a supplanter. He was evil, as was his brother. But God said, I have loved him. And there lies the mystery of love. Why does anyone turn his eyes this direction and not that direction? A young man will go into a room with 12 girls, and he'll look around and he'll say, oh, some enchanted evening across the room, a crowded room, I saw her and I said, that's for me. Why? There is no logic in it. There is none. It's love. Now God says, I've created that. You can see it all over the human race. And God says, I do it because I want you to understand that I have the right to love as I love. And I have loved Jacob. And I have set my heart on him and his people. Now these passages which I have given show that God planned the future of his people. And planned and announced that he would not cast them off. So that no matter whatever happened in Jacob thereafter, God said, I am going to bless Jacob. God was going to vindicate his sovereignty. And he was going to dispose of his grace entirely as he desired. God wants you to know, for this is a lesson for you and for me, the tremendous lesson for you and for me, that every one of us, each one of us, is totally indebted to God. And that we're totally indebted to God for all of his grace and for all hope of mercy and of salvation. And this leads me to the discussion of the sovereignty of God in our lives. First of all, God is our creator. And as our creator, he had a sovereign right over all. We remember that God revealed himself to Abraham as El Elyon, the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. Shall this piece of inert matter, this metal, this wood, cry out and say, God, you didn't give me life. This metal might say, you didn't give me life like you did the tree. And shall the vegetables cry out and say, God, you made us vegetables. And we would like to have had animal life. And shall animal life cry out and say, God, you didn't make us men. Then shall men cry out and say, but God, you made us lower than the angels. Why, says God, I had the same right as the potter over the clay. For many years I had on my desk a little vase. One day in France, we were visiting a potter who had the old potter's wheel, the same as has been used for thousands of years. And all of us were taking our hand at making vases, or plates, or cups, or other things. And the potter was there beside us, making them on his wheel and showing us. And I got a lump of clay, and I put it down, and I made a vase. And I worked at it and worked at it to get it thin and beautiful and the shape I wanted. And when I had it spinning around there, it looked just right to me. And I thought, well, perhaps just at the bottom I might make it go in slightly more. So I pressed my finger there to do it, and my finger went right through it and toppled the whole thing over. So the bottom of the vase was stuck to the wheel, and the top of the vase was a mass of clay. And then I saw an illustration, and I said to the potter, will you take that very piece of clay and make a beautiful vase for me? So he took that very piece of clay, put water on it, molded it anew, and fashioned a very beautiful vase. And then after it was dried, we were staying just across the street at the time, and the next day we came in and he started to paint it, ready for the firing. And my wife took the pencil of the potter, the brush, and began to do some of the designing. And finally, it was put in and it was fired. And I received the vase when it was strong and hard, and for many years it was on my desk until it got knocked over one time and a nick was taken out of it, and the piece is still in it and it's around in a corner someplace. But it was a great picture to me of the fact that what I had marred, a master potter was able to take the same thing and to make it over again. It's also a great picture of the fact, in the whole potter's work, that here was a lump of clay, and the potter reached out and takes a lump of clay, and he throws it down rather hard into the center of the wheel. And I say, as it spins around, what's that lump of clay going to be? Well, he says, I haven't decided yet. Shall I make a cup? Shall I make a saucer? Shall I make a pitcher? Shall I make a vase? Shall I make a plate? Shall I make a bowl? And then in his sovereign will, he says, I'm going to make this. Now God says, I have the same right over you, lumps of dirt. And we all cry out, but I... And God says, that is the most horrible screech in the world. That you want to be other than I want you to be. For when I want you to be something, there is your greatest good and there is your greatest glory. Now, who then in all the universe can have any claim on God? Remember that fact. The scripture everywhere teaches us that no man has any claim on God. No man can have any claim on God at present. Certainly Adam had no claim on God. None whatsoever. If when Adam sinned, God had taken him and sent him to hell, as a potter might take a lump of clay and throw it in the corner, it would have been God's right to do so had he wished. Well then, if when Adam was first created, if God had all power over him then, do you mean to say that man has acquired some power over God by the fall? In the centuries that have since elapsed, has the increasing rebellion of man given him rights over God? The fact that some man declares rebellion against a king, does that give the subject rights over the king in any way? Not only as creator does God have full authority over us, but as governor of the universe. In all the things that God does, he has all rights over us. Now we recognize clearly that we have the right to do whatever we please with that which is our own. A father can make a will and he can give 90% to one son and 10% to another if he wishes. We go to the parable of the laborers in the vineyard. And the Lord Jesus spoke of the fact that a man went out into the marketplace at 8 o'clock in the morning and said, I want some men to go out and pick grapes. in my vineyard. What's the prevailing rate of pay? They said, $5 a day. All right, I hire you. Go out. And he needed more men. And at 10 o'clock, he went out and said, go out and work. And at noon, he went out and sent some more. And at 4 o'clock, he got some more. And at 6 o'clock, when the work day was over, the men who had begun at 4 o'clock and had worked 2 hours, he handed them $5 apiece. And the men who had worked from noon, he handed $5 apiece. And the men who had worked from 10 o'clock in the morning, he handed $5 apiece. And the men who had worked from 8 o'clock in the morning, he handed $5 apiece. And the 8 o'clock one said, don't we have any rights? Why, certainly you do. You have your right to your $5 a day. That's the prevailing rate. We agreed upon it. But you gave them $5 for 2 hours. Well, isn't it my money? Don't I have the right to do what I please with it? Now, the labor unions would tell you no, but God would tell you yes. And it's one of the things that will ultimately be a part in the destruction of our nation, that men will rise up and say that the clay shall tell the potter how things are to be run. And let's not forget that the rise of the clay is a part of that great mystery of iniquity which ultimately shall destroy all civilization and bring the wrath of God upon it. And men hate restraint because they hate God. And any restraint that comes upon man is a symbol of the restraint that God has upon them. Now, if it is lawful for us to do what we please with what is ours, shall we make a law against God doing it?